So, sorry, what time? Again, we're going till
about 11.
Around 11, okay. So, as we've learned through the Maior Makomos this morning, so the topic is following a parent's minhagim. That's like what we're used to. We're used to two things that I think most of the people in this room probably came in with that assumption. Now, one is, as a child, I follow my father's minhag. That's number one. And the second one, which perhaps is not as well known, I think most people here probably would be familiar with it, that when a husband and a wife get married, and they might come from different homes, they might have different minhagim. So whose minhag do we follow when it's the husband and the wife?
Husband,
right? Everybody knows that. We all follow the husband. A couple of years ago, I got started on this topic. But I said, what is the source for that? And I tried looking around. Where does the Gemara talk about a husband and wife following different minhagim, etc.? And there is no source for that, until you get to the 19th century, until you get to the tshuva of Rav Moshe that we talk about later on in this section. I didn't know of any other source that when you have a husband and wife coming from different households, they should follow the man's minhag over the wife's minhag. So where did Rav Moshe come up with that idea? But before we get that, why not? Certainly that concept probably should have come up at some point in the last 2,000 years, that you have a husband and wife that are coming from somewhat different households, different cities, they got married to each other, we know such stories. So the question never came up. Why should that question, based on what we've learned so far, why should that question never have come up? Right? What really, then, based on what we've learned, is the source for what minhag we follow when there are different different positions within a family, or different cities, etc.? What do we follow? What do we learn? It's really the first words of the source sheet that we learned today. Anybody? What are the first words of what we learned today? Mishnah, what? Minhag of the place, makom shenagu. That is the minhag. We follow the minhag of the place, and that's going to decide what we paskin. No matter where we come from. So wherever one is living, right? Whatever the rav of that community is going to paskin the shailas is going to be a tradition in how that city kept various things. There might be various stringencies that city has kept for a very long time. So if you live in that city, you follow those minhagim, and when you move to a different city, guess what? You drop those minhagim and you pick up the new minhagim. That seems to be, when you learn through the Mishnayos, that is what comes up. This Mishnah in Maseches Pesachim is the first Mishnah of the Perek Makom Shenagu. That entire perek is listing off makom shenagu, and a place that does this and a place that does that. That's what the entire chapter is discussing. This Mishnah happens to be discussing the idea of doing malacha on Erev Pesach in the morning. Some people had the minhag the entire day of not doing malacha, and some people only had the minhag in the afternoon. That happens to be a din even b'zman hazeh. That's quoted in Shulchan Aruch. No malacha the afternoon of Erev Pesach. Now, don't worry, you can still cook, you can still prepare for yontif, don't worry. But there is an ideal of not doing malacha. The laws of Chol HaMoed, so to speak, apply on Erev Pesach as well. That's based on this Mishnah. It continues on having to do with issues of Malacha on Tisha B'Av, not doing work on Tisha B'Av. Those kinds of things are all mentioned over the duration of that parak. But what do we learn from here? It's Makom Shenagu. And what if you go to another place? What if you go and visit, you go to your parents for Pesach, which are living in another place? So whose minhag do you follow? Do you follow yours or do you follow theirs? So the Mishnah tells us you follow the minhag of the place where you're going. However, there's a major exception that the Mishnah has. What's the major exception? That if the minhag of the place where you're going is lenient, and your minhag is to be strict, meaning the place where you're going does not do malach on Erev Pesach, and you come from a place where you do, so you should. The opposite. You go into a place where they do, and you come from a place where they don't. So you want to maintain your stringency because you're not planning on living there. So you want to maintain your stringency. So do you keep the minhag? What minhag do you keep? So the Gemara actually, yeah.
You don't
do malacha. You're going to stick out. Everybody else is running around driving, and you're not. So the Gemara actually raises that question, and the Gemara responds by saying, you know, Kama Butley Ika Bashuk. There's a lot of people that waste their time. You know, you're not going to stick out because you happen to not be doing anything. But that's what that first Mishnah tells us. The second source that we have of B'nai Baishan. So what is that about? So Nog de Lohavi Azli Mitzur Litzidun Vamali Shabta. That these people in Baishan had the minhag that they would not travel on Erev Shabbos. It's a pretty good idea. Those people that perhaps were at work, not this past Friday, but the previous Friday, and got stuck. I had a few people in my shul that had to walk a few miles because of the snow. They weren't able to get home in time for Shabbos, so they might appreciate this minhag that they had in that town, that we're not going to We're not going to travel from this place to the other place on Erev Shabbos because of the concern. So the next generation comes up and says, you know, our parents were very frum. Our parents were very religious. We're business people. We need to be able to travel a little bit more often. So they ask, could we annul our parents' minug? It's not really our parents' minug. Can we annul the minug of the place that we're living in? Because that was the previous generation when they were a big tzaddikim, and we're not as big tzaddikim. So could we annul that minug? And what was his answer? His answer was, no. You have a minug of the place. That minug of the place is going to stick. And there's no way of getting out of it. And that's why in the next section, the next source talks about, is a quote from Yeridaya Reishia Dalet. What section of Yeridaya is that? Yeridaya Reishia Dalet. It's not a place that gets opened very much, even by B'nai Yeshiva. It's actually in Hilchos Nedarim, of all places. In the laws of Nedarim, this issue of Minhagim gets discussed. Why do they, why is it, Rav Jan, you want to?
Yeah, just in terms of the way that you just described it.
Yeah.
From that standpoint, it seems a little bit more understandable, but at least in the English sort of subtext here, it was talking about how our parents were more wealthy, and we can't necessarily make ends meet if we don't do it ourselves on our
show. Oh, that's the way it says it there.
It's like it's more surprising.
Okay, either way. Okay, but I mean, the idea still applies. When I learned the sugya, maybe I thank Rabbi Shrezensky for putting the translations in. He's from Sepharia. I remember learning the sugya that has to do with the religious, but it could either way. It's the same din. I mean, we have a minug. The minug is based on astringency. It's a good idea to have that. We can understand why the astringency would exist, no matter how much money we have, right? We understand that, and therefore we're going to maintain that astringency. And
what came up in our particular subordinate was that. Seemed a little bit strange that it's really that the kids really can't make ends meet.
Right.
If parents are wealthy, then it seems like, wow, you're going to keep your father's minhag even when it's putting your life in.
Well, it doesn't necessarily say that. I'm not sure. I don't even think "not make ends meet" even made this translation. I'm not sure. You got to look in the sugya and see how it's understood. But the ideal is, and the way that it's discussed in Shulchan Aruch is that when you have a minhag hamakom, that is a stringency that people are maintaining as a chumrah, that has the din of a neder. So therefore, actually, this is practical. A person is going to take a pious act upon themselves in some way, that I want to be strict about a specific thing, maybe for one time. That I think of some example. I'm going to be strict about this. It behooves a person to say, I am doing this b'li neder. I'm doing this without any ideal that I'm going to be doing this forever. Because if one maintains a practice, a strict practice in some way, so that minug is now supposed to continue. It might have a binding effect of a neder. So therefore, in order to avoid that, a person has to back out of it. But the Shulchan Aruch then concludes on the second source here. We don't have page numbers, but the top of what we would call page 3. The Shulchan Aruch concludes that the place is certainly what establishes what stringencies you're going to keep. Not just l'chumra, not just to be strict, but even to be lenient. That's how he concludes. Shayasurin bahem bi'iram, the second to last line here. Shayasurin harehim kanshi yir v'chayvim l'alach. V'af bidvarim shayasurin bahem bi'iram, things that they were maintaining as prohibited. Mifnei minhagim, according to what their practice was. V'ein minug ha'ir shabo ladur ba'lesor, but the minug of the place you're going to does not hold that it's prohibited. Hutru bahem im ein daitem lachzor, that it is permissible to them if they don't have in mind to go back. So a classic example of this would probably be the kitnios. The prohibition of kitnios on Pesach is probably just a very good paradigm to use, right? So that is clearly a minug. It's a stringency. It's perhaps a geder that is built around the prohibition of chametz, meaning not only are we not going to eat chametz, we're not even going to eat things that look like chametz, right? That's the establishment of the prohibition of kitnios. Now we know that was accepted in Ashkenazi communities and it was not accepted in Sephardi communities. That we understand. So what about, so according to the Shulchan Aruch, if a person was living in Poland in the year 1247 and left Poland and made his way to Iraq, and now set up shop in Iraq. So would he have a prohibition of kitnios upon himself? Would he have to maintain his prohibition of kitnios when he moves to Iraq in the year 1243? No. Right? No. He's done. Great. I get to eat kitnios with everybody else. I could go to my next door neighbor, Saliman, and we'll share our Pesach Seder together. And there's no problem, because even though I might have grown up prohibited to eat kitnios on Pesach, prohibited to eat these beans, now I'm permissible, totally 100% permissible for me to do it based on the fact that I have now moved to this place, and not just moved there, but as the Shulchan Aruch says, ein daitam lachzor, meaning I have now moved to Iraq, and that is the place that I intend on staying. So assuming that has happened, so I can now accept those new minhagim, bein l'chumra, bein l'kula, whether it's strict or whether it means lenient. Yeah. So no, we're still in 1247 or so. We're gonna get to nowadays. Yes.
Are you supposed to follow the minhag of your city or your father?
So what we've learned so far, everything we have learned so far is all about the city, right? That's what we've learned, which is why. Okay, that's gotta stick around. Yes.
If people move around without, they may intentionally move somewhere with the intention of staying there, and then something comes up.
Okay.
And change the
makom. Sure. A person could change their makom several times over the course of their life, but it depends on what their ideal is. We're moving now to Baghdad. I'm going to live here for the rest of my life. If I'm going to live here for 2-3 years, and then I'm going to go back. I'm here to get my finish graduate school at the University of Baghdad, and then I intend on moving back to Krakow in the year 1247. So, okay, I would maintain, that's the first Mishnah, right? I maintain the chumras of where I come from. I would actually still be prohibited from eating kitnios, and that would be because I have in mind to go back. But once I'm there, and I assume I'm going to stay there forever, so I assume I'm going to stay there forever. The Rambam here seems to perhaps take a different tact on it. The Rambam seems to be saying that you have to maintain your minhagim even if you don't have in mind to go back. That's what he seems to be saying. How does one understand that? So there's a shach. There's several answers to how to understand that Rambam. The shach explains that the Rambam was talking about when you didn't have a destination yet. I mean, I know I'm leaving Poland. I'm just not sure if Baghdad is my final destination. So if I'm not sure I'm staying in Baghdad, I might be moving on to New Delhi or something. So I can't accept the kulas yet until I know where I'm staying. That perhaps is an understanding that the Rambam has of the Shach. Okay. So that was, we're still in the 1200s. Now we're going to move ahead into the 1500s. Yes?
If you live in more than one place throughout the year, are you supposed to follow?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I would suggest you ask your local Orthodox rabbi that. But you realize that idea that, I have two houses, and I go to Israel, and I spend half the year in Israel and half the year in America, right? So that's a modern phenomenon, right? When you were spending 3 months on a boat going from place to place, you weren't exactly so quick to just go back and forth and have a summer home here and a winter home there, right? That didn't really happen so much. Okay, so now we're adding into the 1500s. Now, I know based on Yeshua's quizzes that he has to take in Rabbi Silver's year, that we know a little bit about Rav Yosef Karo. Right? Rav Yosef Karo, again, Rav Yosef Karo was born where? Anybody know? Yes?
Egypt?
No. You fell for it. Good. Rav Yosef Karo was born in Spain. He was born in Spain in the year 1488. Now, 1488 was a pretty tough time to be growing up in Spain if you were Jewish, because you knew that in a couple of years later there was going to be something called the Spanish Inquisition, right? So obviously that doesn't just happen in a vacuum. It's a pretty difficult time already. And he grew up in that era. His family left as a result of the Spanish Inquisition. His family made his way to Turkey. He spent his younger years in Turkey, ultimately making his way to Eretz Yisrael. There's a bit of to Tzfat in Eretz Yisrael. There's a little bit of a dispute about whether he actually ended up in Egypt for a period of time or whether he didn't end up in Egypt for a period of time. But his last name was Karo, whether or not he lived in Egypt. His name was Karo beforehand. So the Beis Yosef was living in Tzfat in the year over the course of the 1500s. He is recognized, and he recognizes himself as being the leader, as being the Gadol Hador, certainly for that region of the world. They weren't necessarily in email contact with the rest of Europe, but certainly in that part of the world, he is recognized as the Gadol Hador. Yes?
So around the time of the Holocaust, my great-grandparents, so they lived in Poland,
And then before the Holocaust around, they were taken and moved to like Russia, and then they were moved all around.
Okay, so where did they come from?
So they originally were from Poland.
Right.
But then they were moved.
Right. So these are important issues. We're still in the 1500s. We'll get to the 1900s soon. Okay? 1900s is very important. But right now we're still in the year 1500, 1550 or so. Okay? So Yosef Karo is a Rav in Tzfat. Who lives in Tzfat during that time? So there are native Tzfatians that have been there for a very long time. Besides having native Tzfatians, there are also a bunch of refugees from Spain that have made their way there. Spain was not the only place that had an Inquisition during that period. Also Portugal did, and also a couple of countries in Europe. I mean, there weren't Jews allowed in a lot of different places in Europe. So a lot of these Jews are now making their way to Tzfat. You now have tens of thousands of Jews in Tzfat from a lot of different places. So Yosef Karo is, I think, the unofficial Rav of Tzfat, and he's looking around and saying, we got a bit of a problem here because we have so many people and all of their understandings of halacha, not all, you know, but there's a significant amount of people that have very different understandings of halacha from each other. So how are we going to resolve, how are we going to have a cohesive community when we have so many different people from so many different places? So he says, you know what? I'm going to write a book. And this book is going to paskin the halachos for Klal Yisrael. His understanding, we're going to paskin the halacha for all the Jews, certainly in our area, but he intends this is going to be the entire world. And we're going to decide what the halacha is. Now, there are two major chidushim. There are two major things, major changes that Rav Yosef Karo did during that time. Because in the hundreds of years leading up to Rav Yosef Karo was known as the period of the Rishonim. Does that name like ring a bell to people? The Rishonim. So give me examples of Rishonim.
Rashi.
Rashi's a Rishon, yes.
Rambam.
Rambam's a Rishon. Who else? Any other Rishonim? People that have, you know, the rule of thumb generally is that if they have letters in their name, you know, like Rashi, Ramban, Rambam, Ritva, Rashba, etc., right? All of those are the Rishonim, right? And if their names are either Svarim or long names with a last name, they're generally Achronim. That's like a good rule of thumb, although it doesn't always hold true. So how did the Rishonim learn? I mean, when the Ritva learned, the Ritva had a Rebbe, his name was the Ramban. How did the Ramban learn? How did the Ramban have his understanding of Gemara? So the Ramban's understanding of Gemara came from his Rebbe. And the assumption is that the Rishonim had, you know, give or take, they had a specific Mesorah as to how they paskin. They learned from their Rebbe, learned from their Rebbe, learned from their Rebbe, learned from their Rebbe, going back to the time of the Gemara, and then from the Gemara going back to the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. That is the assumption, that they had their own tradition, and that is how they wrote. As opposed to, what did Rav Yosef Karo do, however? Rav Yosef Karo said, I don't really have a tradition. I've traveled around from place to place. I grew up in Spain, went to Turkey, came to Tzfat. Rav Yosef Karo said, instead of having a tradition from my Rebbe, I have a tradition of books. And he's actually the first person to collect books, to have a very large library, and say, I'm going to take a vote. We're going to look around at all the books. What do all the books say? And whatever the majority of the books say, so that's how we're going to paskin. And in fact, he picked three main books that we're going to paskin like, even though he listed the others. Anybody know those three were? I think that was covered on one of the quizzes I saw. The Rambam paskin, the Beis Yosef, for Yosef Karo paskin like three books, yeah? What?
Magen Mishnah?
He wrote the Magen Mishnah, but he wrote paskin based on the Rambam. Right, the Rambam, the Riff, and the
Rambam, and the
Rush. Right, the Rambam, the Riff, and the Rush. It's written down here. So he's going to take best of three. Whoever wins best of three, that's how we're going to pass in the halacha. Now, the truth is the voting was rigged. Right, it was a rigged election. Why was it a rigged election? Plus, the Rambam and the Riff were two Sephardim, and the Rush was an Ashkenazi. And not only that, the Rambam almost always passes like the Riff. So it was kind of a rigged vote. So he said, all right, that's how we're going to paskin, and that's the way it's going to be paskin for the rest of the world. To make a long story short, there is somebody else who is a Rav in Krakow at the same time, thinking about the same issues. His name is Rav Moshe Isserles. He is sitting down and writing his own book called The Darkei Moshe, which is going to do the same thing as the Beis Yosef. I'm going to collect all the books, all the svarim. I'm going to put them together. I'm going to decide. And while he is writing his book, a knock comes at the door. It's the It's the yeshiva in Tzfat that's trying to do a fundraiser. And they say, here's a book. You know, here's the book that was published by Arush Yeshiva. The Ramah looks at it and says, Gevalt. He's doing the same thing that I was trying to do. But he's coming to different conclusions. Was his Papsakim are all Sephardim and my Papsakim are all going to be Ashkenazi? And therefore, rather than writing his own separate book, he decided to merge them together. And that book is what we know now today as the Beis Yosef / Darchei Moshe. And then 20 years later as the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, when you have the Mechaber versus the Ramah over the course of the page. So, again, what were his two chidushim? He said we're going to paskin based on books. And the second thing he said we're going to do, we're going to try to establish a common practice for everyone. We're going to have one practice for all of Klal Yisrael rather than have different minhagim. Now, he himself had the same issue. Yosef Karo had the same challenge of different of Ashkenazim settling in Sephardic communities. He has tshuvos about that, but maybe we'll skip around. We'll skip a little bit forward. So what did and but he passed? But how did he assume still to be passed in terms of makom shenagu, in terms of the place? Right, if you go from one place and move to another place, how did he say you should paskin halacha? So he said ideally you should paskin like. Ideally, right, if we have a question, I go here, I go there, how did he say you should paskin? If you were to ask Yosef Karo, how did he say you should paskin? Ideally, you should paskin like me, right? And that's what he said. He said, ideally, you should paskin like my book. But he still recognized that not everybody did so, and he acknowledged the idea that there might be different minhagim, and he maintained that practice, as we saw, as he wrote in the Shulchan Aruch. If you go from one place to another place, you paskin like the place where you are. Okay. So now we've done 1200s, 1500s, and now we're going to travel into the 1900s. The 1900s, although there were significant upheavals in the 1600s and other times, the next major upheaval of the Jewish community, where people ended up in a totally different place than where they were, was in the 1900s, in the period before the Holocaust and the period after the Holocaust, where all of a sudden you took Jews from all over Europe. I mean, I just think my family, my four grandparents, one is from Eastern Poland, one's from Galicia, one is from Germany, and one is from Hungary. Right? Those are my four grandparents. So I don't know how they all got together. That is a reality that all of a sudden we're confronting in America for the first time. People didn't travel around like this. Back in the day, all of a sudden you have all these people that are thrown together. How are we going to paskin those shilas? So the maid, yes. So now we're back to your grandmother.
Yeah. So my great grandparents, they moved from first to Poland, then to Russia. They moved all around
right. The
world. They moved from Europe to Asia to Europe again to Israel to America. They were moved all around.
Right. So where are they from?
They're from Poland.
Ah. Well, let's stop right there. They're from Poland. Right? They're from Poland. And in fact, Rav Moshe, there is a Gemara here, another Gemara that talks about Minhagim in terms of laborer, where the Gemara raises the issue of, well, what happens if you have a place where there are no Minhagim? So the Gemara answers, well, if you have no Minhagim, where did they come from? Follow where they came from. Where did they come from? That's what the Gemara questions. The Gemara says, well, they came from a lot of different places. And the Gemara says, all right, fine, then we're going to have to figure out another way of resolving the issue. But the Gemara is raising the idea that if you don't have a minug of the place, what should you follow? The minug of where you came from, right? You should follow the minug of where you came from. That's sort of Moshe's idea. But the problem is, when you come to America, so you can walk around, if you go to a place like the Lower East Side, even till today, you'll see the signs up. If you go to a place like Borough Park, Borough Park is probably the best example of this. You walk around, and you see there's different shuls from many different places. Even the large Hasidic sects, right? There's Babov is there, and Munkach is there, and those are the big ones. There's also a Chabad place there. There's also Satmar is there. There's a lot of mixtures of people. You go from block to block, you're going to see shuls from many different places. So Rav Moshe said, you know, this is wild. There's no way that we're going to be able to establish a minhag of the place where we're at, because everybody is coming from so many different places. So Rav Moshe acknowledged that. Rather than fight it, and we'll have time to get to the second, perhaps why he didn't fight it. But rather than fight it, Rav Moshe just simply acknowledged it. He says, you know what, that's the reality. The reality here is that you can go from block to block, and you're going to see that every single shul is going to have their own minhagim based on the place where they were. What's the large shul now today on the Lower East Side? It's called the Bialystok Shul. Where are you from? Right. The Bialystok Shul. Why is it called the Bialystok Shul? Because it was founded by people from Bialystok. Right, that happens to be the shul that you know, that survived. But there's shuls from all these different cities. If you go in Lower East Side and other such neighborhoods. So Rav Moshe acknowledged the idea that we're simply a gathering of many different people that have been placed in the same place. So therefore, what do you follow? When you have a question in terms of what halacha should you follow? So ideally, he says, you should follow the place from where you came, right? So that works if you came from there. So your grandmother, she knows she came from Poland, even if she made five other stops along the way.
Because they did not remember any of their minhagim. They didn't remember their birthdays. They made up their own birthdays. They were young when they were moving.
That's fair, right? But they know they're Polish, and they didn't go back to Asia to figure out their roots. They went to Poland to figure out their roots. So all of us, we go back. So that works in terms of the person who came from there. What about the child of the person who came from there? So Rav Moshe says, so they're going to follow their family minhag. And that's where the great switch happened. The great switch happened in that period where instead of saying we're going to follow the minhag of the place, we're now going to follow the minhag of the place you came from. And if you came from here, you're going to follow the minhag of your father who came from that place. And that's what, Rav Moshe has many tshuvos where he consistently assumes that idea. So one tshuva, the tshuva we had here, has it with first half of sphira and the second half of sphira. So right, some people have sphira that we start from Pesach and go to Lag BaOmer, and some people start from Rosh Chodesh Iyar and go to the end and go up to Rosh Chodesh Sivan. So how did that come about? Okay, there's two different minhagim. So what should one do? What should you maintain? So Rosha says, listen, you know, you have some people doing this, some people doing that. We can't prohibit you from going to your friend's chasana just simply because he davens in the next shul over. So you will acknowledge his minug. I heard in Baltimore they're like makbid on second half, right?
They set second half.
The
Nassau City, the yeshiva, I think, set one, and the city has the other.
Okay. So if you have a shul with a strong, a community with a strong central leadership, which perhaps doesn't exist in the entire country, right? They have the ability to say, we're going to keep this minhag for our city. If that's the case, they actually probably do have the ability to set up a minhag amakom, and there are communities that have this to some extent or another. But ultimately, it doesn't happen. What's the ultimate proof of that? The ultimate proof of that is that in my shul, and probably in all shuls also, there's probably five Sephardic families, right? Those five Sephardic families, they are the minority, as much as they might not want to admit it, right? They often are the minority, but do they maintain their Sephardic practices? 100%. They maintain their Sephardic practices, because even though technically they're in another makom, they're still going to maintain the original practices. Rav Moshe knocks aside the issue of lo tisko to do his concern about the concern that you're going to have different people doing different things. He authorizes the idea of, in the Mishnah Berurah, it's explicit that you can't have on Chol HaMoed. This is one of the big issues. Can you have people davening with tefillin, people not davening with tefillin in the same room? Shulchan Aruch says, absolutely not. It looks terrible. Some people are doing it, some people are not. Rav Moshe says, everybody knows what the issue is. People aren't davening. When you daven minyan in the morning is often the place that's closest to work, or the place that's closest to the bus stop. Right, it's not necessarily where you're assuming your minhag is going to be. Rav Moshe says he's okay with people davening with tefillin and people not davening with tefillin in the same room. He says you should avoid it, but if it's not a problem if it happens. The other issue, by the way, of husbands and wives. So men and women are coming from different mishpachos. What do we do about that when men and women have different families? So we said before, the assumption always is we follow the man. Why do we follow the man? So I mentioned before, it's very hard to find a source as to why we follow the man before Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe was asked this shaila, right? Why did it not come up before? As we said, because you always just followed, you followed the place, you asked the rabbi what he does, right? You followed the minhag hamakom. You didn't have this idea of having your own family minhag, but now you do. So how do you follow the men and women? So Rav Moshe scratches his head, he like kind of strokes his beard, says, well, I guess it's best to follow the man. Why is it best to follow the man? Because we kind of have this assumption that when the husband and wife are getting married, the woman is moving into the man's house. But in theory, you could kind of push it the other way as well. But that's the way he says. The woman moves into the man's house, so therefore it's like she's leaving her place and going into his place, so therefore his menhagim are assumed. However, there's plenty of tshuvos that say that you could do it the other way too. You decide to do it the other way, you can decide to do it the other way too. There are other tshuvos that say that if a woman wants to maintain a specific practice that she has, she certainly is permitted to do so, assuming that it doesn't impact on the marriage. She's permitted to maintain her own private practices, her own chumras, etc. So Rav Moshe sets that as the ideal, but there are many instances when such a thing perhaps doesn't play out. So just to conclude, and I guess we have a few moments for questions, just to conclude. So we saw this major change that Rav Moshe did. Instead of paskin based on the place, we now paskin based on, let me just finish and then we'll do the questions, all right? Right, and then we'll paskin based on your family and try to maintain family menhagim. Why did he do that? Why did he change? So I think there's three, and why did he not do what the Shulchan Aruch did? Right, the Shulchan Aruch, when he was confronted with a very similar thing, said, I'm going to paskin like one way and everybody's going to follow me. So why did Rav Moshe not do that? So I think I've come up with three reasons. Number one is because Rav Moshe realized I didn't have the power to do so. It just simply, he was a Rav in America, and there are other Rabbanim in America. The Sakhba Rav would not have agreed with Rav Moshe Pesachim. Others, perhaps the Yeshiva University, the Rav Soloveitchik world, would not necessarily all be willing to sign on with Rav Moshe Pesachim, as good of a relationship they had. The reality was that people had their Minhagim, and they were going to maintain that, despite the fact that perhaps there would be one leader. That's one possibility. Another possibility is, and that's really the last source, is Rav Moshe's was a fierce individualist. One can claim that this, you know, there might be psychological reasons based on growing up in Russia during the communist revolution and trying to be a Rav there. But the Rav Moshe felt very strongly that people are entitled, once you know how to learn and once you have a start, and if you're able to figure out what the halacha is, you're entitled to your opinion. I'm not going to impose myself on you. You want to ask me what I think? Great, you can come and ask me. If you don't want to ask me, so you don't have to come and ask me. He was very loath to impose his power on other people. If one wants to, this is said explicitly, really, in the introduction to Igros Moshe. It's also said explicitly in a New York Times interview that he granted. I have it someplace on my computer. I think in the 70s, he was asked about Psak Halacha in the New York Times, and he gives that type of answer to the New York Times. The third answer, I think, is also that Rav Yosef Karo, and if we learn more about Tzfat during that period, the people of Tzfat really felt 100% that Mashiach is coming. They thought that this is it. We have Kovetz Golios. People are gathering together. And we are setting ourselves up for the ultimate Geula. There's things about Smicha. They reinvented Smicha. When I subbed here, we talked about Smicha a little bit. So they reinvented Smicha, the official Smicha. At least they tried to. And there are other things as well that they felt that the Geula is coming. And we are hereby preparing ourselves for the Geula. We're in Eretz Yisrael. And we're going to establish Halacha for the entire Klal Yisrael. Rav Moshe was not in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Moshe was in America. And perhaps it was an acknowledgement of Ki Mitzion Tetze Torah, that kind of thing, that we're going to have a project where everybody's going to have the same thing, where everybody's going to ultimately paskin, that's something that's left for people in Eretz Yisrael, and probably he felt even that's meant for Mashiach, that's meant for the ultimate Geula. Until then, until we get to that point, so we continue to, you know, fight it out. There's going to be Malkum Shanagu this, Malkum Shanagu that. There's going to be families that do this, and there's going to be families that do that. There is an idea of diversity of Klal Yisrael. We have idea of Aseli Matamim, the Medrash tells that Hashem perhaps wants a variety. Different Shvatim represent a variety of Avodas Hashem. And this is a challenge that we work through when we have different communities and different families that are living together, perhaps having different practices, different stringencies, different leniencies. And that perhaps is a way of evolving and bringing about a greater understanding of the entire Torah. So thank you very much for this opportunity. If there are any quick questions, I think there's a few more moments. You want to ask something? Yeah. Okay. That's not, Rav Moshe doesn't mention that. Rav Moshe's tshuva about this topic, that's not his assumption. You could. Well, which one's which?
For Judaism, for Yadis, right?
Yeah.
Judaism. religion comes from the woman, but
right.
Halacha comes from the
Right, but it's called Musar Avicha and Torah Simecha, right? So there's no source. I mean, the Gemara doesn't talk about that. In fact, the Gemara quoted that source as following Minhag HaMakom. That was in the second source on the page. That pasuk is invoked by the Gemara. How do you know you have to maintain the family, the practices of where you come from? Shema Bini Musar Avicha V'Al Torah Titash Torah Simecha. What? What does one have to do with the other? The answer is that's just the Masorah that we're going to follow. It's not really based on parents. Okay, but I think that's really, that pasuk is really, not, I don't think the pasuk is really being invoked halakhically. It's really being invoked to just mention the idea that there's a tradition that you would pass on from generation to generation. Yeah?
What if family, parents, grandparents were Bali Tshuva?
Good question. It's a good question. So I think the ideal is to follow the community which one is in. So how do you figure what that is? So then you probably would talk to the Rav. I had when I was in Phoenix, I had a family that was converting. And they were Mexican. So they came in, but you know, they look Mexican, they look Sephardi, but they're not Sephardi, they're Mexican. Right? And they had that, they asked me, so what practice do we follow? And for some reason they said, we kind of feel we want to be Sephardic. Like, we've just learned about that, we want to be Sephardic. Now, they're not, they're Mexican. You know, there are stories in their family about candlelight, things like that, but that was the shaila. Can we be Sephardic even though we're davening in your shul, which is an Ashkenazi shul? So that Rav Schechter actually paskin yes. Rav Schechter said, if they want to associate themselves with the Sephardic community, even while davening in Ashkenazi shul, that's okay. That's okay. They're associating themselves with a different community. Yes?
Before you said it was possible for the husband to take the wife's niqab, or just the wife to keep her own?
No, in theory, the couples could decide together. Rav Moshe doesn't say this in his tshuva.
They all have to keep the same niqab, is what you're saying?
I would recommend they keep the same minug. But when they could decide we're going to be in this community, so to speak, and keep the wives' family, they could also a woman could also decide, I have this stringency that I have myself, I'm not going to impose upon the family, so she's permitted to do that. You're allowed to have personal minhagim as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes?
Would you say that Moshe would have ideally wanted to preserve the idea of minhag HaMakom, but he just thought that it was sort of impossible and people weren't going to go for it because of all the disprotection?
Yeah.
You know, you think that would still have been the ideal if it was really possible to maintain it?
I don't know. I don't know of any history where Rav Moshe seems to lean that way. He seems to be very comfortable with this in America. He talks about we have New York and we have Brooklyn and it's okay. He doesn't. I don't, from reading the tshuva, I don't get a sense that he's upset about it. So this is our reality here. And yeah.
Would you say that? I mean, what did he do for generations before that? When it seemed that Rav Moshe wasn't the first one to confront the reality of it. There was probably close to generations prior to that.
You mean in America?
Yeah.
In America, Yehudim Haisa Ayurvasim. It was a big challenge. I learned the history of America in the 1800s, 1900s. It was a big challenge. A bigger challenge made because you had what we would call today non-Orthodox movements that had not established themselves as such. Right? So the Reform movement in America was kind of like, oh yeah, that's what they do. It wasn't necessarily that there was a break yet at that point. It was a big challenge as to what we do about these different groups. And this fought itself out. It's not as clear because the scholarship isn't as intense as it was in Europe. But certainly this challenge of, do we try to keep ourselves as one minug, or do we separate ourselves out, goes back centuries in America, right? The first shul in America was the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. And then Mikveh Israel and the Turo synagogue. All of them were Sephardic. So at some point, these Ashkenazis came around and said, are we going to be with them, or are we going to start our own communities? And obviously, at some point, they decided we're starting our own communities. Yeah. Okay, yes?
Are you allowed to change your minhag?
Changing your minhag is a good question. The term minhag can mean many different things, which is a bit of a problem in talking about this topic, right? Minhag sometimes means to, oh, this is, our minhag is to walk to shul this way. Sometimes the minhag might be, we eat this food on Pesach, that's our minug. And sometimes minug can mean we have a specific chumrah for a specific thing. So it depends on what it is, and that's going to take longer than the time that we have now. Yes?
Minug backwards is gehenna.
That is true, but we also have an idea of minhag oker halacha, which is a positive thing. So how do we understand minhagim is a good thing, but you have to invite me back for another discussion on that. All right, thank you very much.